Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello and welcome back. There was something Susie said last week. Oh, it was just wow, you know, one of those phrases that just you have to write it down. And said we have to behave as if we already trusted the spirits, which basically means trusting yourself, doesn't it, and being prepared to make an absolute prat of yourself if necessary, because sometimes it won't be the spirits. But I think it comes a point where you get the difference. It's in Judaism and Christianity, it's the still small voice that's the divine, and it seems to me that it comes sort of left from left field when it's a voice from the spirits. It's just something that
for me it's something that lands in my head in a way that's that I'd, it sounds a bizarre thing to say, but I didn't think it on purpose.
Yes,
and in it pops is the kind of more overt way. Although, yeah, for me, I do have visions, if you like, where, again, unasked for and uninvited, I will see something.
Is that see with third eye or see with eyes?
I guess it's see with third eye, because I'm not seeing something in this reality that other people could see.
Yeah.
But my experience of it is as if I was seeing it with my actual,
so it human appears to be physical.
It appears to be physical, but it is clearly not physical because it's not taking place in the landscape that my eyes are looking in.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
So that kind of visions pop up unannounced, words pop in unannounced, or simply knowings, and I've had that always.
Literally always.
And the knowings used to get me into a huge amount of trouble. The seeings were dismissed as the ramblings of a child and were possibly part of the acquisition of the name witch. But the knowings or the voice in my head type of thing, which, oh my goodness, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. I have a beloved friend who's recently been sectioned. And, you know, is clearly in a great deal of mental distress, but is, and, you know, for all kinds of terribly sad reasons, became so confused that he needed to be sectioned. And was realising, oh, he said the most heartbreaking thing. I said something like I was talking to you or writing something, I don't know, about something like speaking on behalf of nature. And to him, that was so impossibly sad, because if he said something like that, it would simply be confirmation of him being a total and utter nutter.
Yes.
And, you know, he's a profoundly spiritual person.
Yes.
And it just, I've been carrying this around me as this really, like, sharp sort of knife of awareness that I am so fucking privileged to be able to sit here and say, there are voices in my head. I see things you cannot see, and no one's offering to burn me at the stake or lock me up.
Mm.
So privileged. And even in the 21st century, you know, yeah, he was confused, but it's a history of saying things like, well, I was having a chat with the oak tree. That is part of how come he is easier to lock up than a lot of people.
Oh, yes. And this is a favourite rant of mine. Well, it's going to become a favourite rant of mine. I've only ranted to my husband about it so far. So this is the first public rant on this subject. I have noticed over the last 20 years that I have never on the television seen a positive depiction of a holistic person.
No, I don't think I have either.
They're a therapist or into crystals or something like that, and they are always off with the fairies, but not in a good way. They're always proved wrong. They're always proved to be illusionary. And I'm going to start some kind of campaign, and I don't know how I'm going to do it, and God grant me the strength and show me which way to go. But we have to start changing this picture that is presented. Now, there is a lot of the New Age and a lot of holistic stuff that is seriously out of kilter and harmful. There is a lot of Christianity that is seriously off kilter and harmful. There's a lot of Islam, there's a lot of Hinduism, there's a lot of Judaism that is seriously off kilter and harmful. But in the root, like everything else, there is magic and mystery and truth. Mm. And while we continue to present men and women in our media, when they talk about being holistic, as being fake
or wacky,
yeah, or deceitful, or just outright deluded, it's really hard for us to move on. And that's one of the important things about this podcast, and one of the important things about why I chose to be ordained, because I would be able to say, I can hear angels sometimes, and the spirits of the dead do call, talk to me sometimes, at the Christian funeral I was doing for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's so, so important. And I think I was a lot more fey than I thought I was as a child. You could pick back over the years the times when people looked at you amiss and you learned not to say anything.
Yes, it took me quite a long time. But yes, yes, I remember that feeling.
Yeah. And I may have said this before, but I had an experience in church during the Magnificat, where Mary or Elizabeth, it's confused now whether which one of it is that's singing it, but we're taught it's Mary singing, "My soul shall magnify the Lord," who has observe the lowliness of his handmaiden or something like that. But it's not as servitude-laden as that. It's a paean of praise. You know, you and I are in relationship and we are having a baby. You, God, and I are having a baby. Which, of course, is metaphorical as well as possibly literal. It's all about the baby that comes through you when you connect with your divinity.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the Trinity. And she's singing, "My soul will magnify the Lord." And I'm standing in church, little old-fashioned Norman church in the middle of Birmingham, and suddenly the whole of my light lit up. I was in complete communion with something that was angelic. And it was colour I could taste. It was song I could see. It's utterly inexplicable, but it was so, so. And it said, "You will do this." What?
Give us the clue.
Give us the clue. It said, "You will do this." And again and again and again, Well, I never told anyone till I was 35 because I had enough intelligence back then to know you don't tell this.
Yeah.
Because, oh, it was a delusion, oh, it was a this, oh, you can't possibly have colours you can taste. And, you know, all the little shutting down that happens to children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a great fan of boundaries for children, but not shutting children down.
Yeah.
So I've always known that there was something around, there's something out there. And I think that "You will do this" is "My soul will magnify the Lord." Quite simple, just that. And hopefully to a certain extent we're doing this here. We wouldn't call it the Lord. We'd probably call it the Great Mother. But the name doesn't matter. It's what the attention we project onto the name becomes the problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so the whatever it is. But if I may, I'd like to tell a story about one of the funerals I did where it was one of those things of having to trust, to behave as though I already trusted.
Mm-hmm.
It was the funeral of a man whose mother had died 2 weeks earlier. That is relevant. He was in his 50s and he just died in his armchair watching telly one night. Wow. Probably his heart gave out or something.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter had booked me to do his funeral. He was very fond of rock and roll. So they tried to do blue suede shoes in flowers on his coffins and it really didn't work. It was sort of a blue suede flower boot.
Right.
Anyway, that's sort of relevant because I was reading the eulogy and I just became aware with peripheral vision that there was a man standing looking at the coffin perplexed.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll understand this if you know about it. I just projected a little bit of attention in that direction and he mm-hmm. turned to me and said, "You can see me, you can see me." And I basically had to say, "Shut up, sit down, I'll talk to you in the hymn."
Mm-hmm.
Because I was reading his eulogy. And we went into the hymn and I sat down behind the pulpit and I thought, well, what are you doing? I thought, you have to trust this. Because if you ignore it and it is a spirit, what damage can you do? So I said, hello, I'm doing your funeral. And he went, it's my mother's funeral. And I went, no, that was 2 weeks ago. You died. Did you not know? He went, no. What a Julie. That was his daughter's name. And I said, she's in the front row. And then I lost his attention because he went to his daughter. And I thought, it was always my practice anyway. I haven't done many funerals lately, obviously. Always my practice with somebody I don't know has a clear faith to go down to the cremators. And the people and the workers there know that I will do that because I will always go down there to be there with the soul in case the body and the soul don't know enough to be separated or whatever's going on. There's never really a problem, but it's quite often a soul standing there going, oh, it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Standing watching their body, you know, because they turned up for their funeral. So I went down there and he was down there and he said that too, oh, it doesn't hurt, you know. And nothing really. I just sort of said, you can get through quite easily. Do you want me to build you a path? Or he said, no, I've got something to do first. And I said, fine, but do you know where to find me if you need to? He said, yes. And he went. And the next day, the phone rang, and it was his daughter. And she said, Maggie, was my dad at the funeral? Please, will you tell me? And I said, yes, Judy, he was. And she said, oh, thank God. Did you see him? Did you? You know, and it was okay to talk to her about this because not have been. Yeah. And I said, why, did you sense him? She said, no, not at all. But after the wake, I went back to his house. I wanted to be on my own and just have some time at the house. And of course, she wasn't able to explain that to any many people even. Mm-hmm. And she said, I walked through the front door and his jukebox turned itself on and played the record he'd named me after.
Oh,
I know. I just thought that was, and she said the jukebox was unplugged at the wall.
Wow.
You know, and you just go, oh God, that's so marvellous, isn't it? And I wish I could share that with more people. I do quite quietly just say he was here.
Yeah.
At the funeral, if I can, if you can get away with it. There's so many people, you can't get away with it. And that, to me, is the fundamental failing of all our religions. Is they were founded, I am quite convinced, they were all founded to make sense of death.
Right.
To help us understand what goes on and the perennial turning of things and the levels within us. And they became about control. And they've just lost this idea. They've just got heaven and hell, or you're going to rest in the earth until the end of days when the second coming, when the Messiah comes. And then you're going to rise up and you're going to have your amputated leg in the grave with you so you can walk into Jerusalem on the last day because your physical body is resurrected. And I just want to bang my head. Excuse me, I'm going to bang my head.
She really is banging her head on the table.
You know, how did we get so arrogant to think that this is just it? I really can't understand it because I talk to people about Kabbalah. This is the Jewish mystical system that I love and I follow and I teach, which is based on, it's an oral tradition, updates with the time, based on two diagrams to stop it being Chinese whispers. Mm-hmm. And the diagrams basically show the pattern, the mathematical pattern the universe is designed on. Mm-hmm. About how it repeats, how certain numbers are sacred, like we have repeatings of fours and repeatings of tens and repeatings of twelves and sevens, and they all have a purpose. And the way that the planets flow is mathematical, you know, they follow particular paths. And if, for example, a great big asteroid hit Jupiter and knocked it out of its cycle in the solar system, the whole solar system would change. Mm-hmm. Our climate would change. Everything would change.
Yeah.
So it's all patterns, and we live in patterns, and our astrology is simply the blueprint of the pattern we have chosen, melded in with our genetics and our karma or whatever. So the astrology is the blueprint pattern, and we've still got free will, but we're so arrogant we don't think we're part of this great pattern. Mm. And the pattern shows us that things die and new things come, or they die and they resurrect. Some plants resurrect. And I'm just passionate about saying to people, there must be some way we can help people come back to talking about death, moving with death, experiencing death, listening to death. I know there are doulas now, and it is getting a lot better than it was, but the death industry.
Oh, it's a sad place, yeah.
Oh, did I tell you about Ketty and the Crows?
No.
My friend Ketty... Oh, it's my turn to tell stories this time.
Yeah, okay, come on, let's hear it.
My friend Ketty is a homeopath in Birmingham. She had a husband called Keith, who died just at the beginning of the pandemic. And Keith was really bonkers spiritual. Keith was a good, lovely man, but sometimes he was so off with the fairies, and he was a Gemini too, so he was always off on different patterns, and he didn't ground stuff very much. I actually found him really annoying, and he knew that, and he was fine with it. Because he was so nice a man, he didn't mind that you found him annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway, Keith loved crows. He used to go and feed a murder of crows in Sutton Park, north of Birmingham, regularly. Whether you like crows or not is irrelevant. Keith loved crows. Them. And he had throat cancer, and he should have died 4 or 5 years ago. But Ketty was wonderful with the homeopathy, and his spiritual work kept him going for a long, long time. And he died perfectly politely and neatly just after the government had issued the proclamations about the awards for businesses. So Ketty got the £10,000 for their business so she could furlough it. And it just worked. You know, it was his timing, I'm sure. But the point of it was, they weren't rich enough to have a big funeral. Well, there weren't going to be big funerals anyway, but they couldn't afford a funeral director, thousands of pounds. It was just not on. So the mortuary agreed to keep Keith's body until Ketty could buy a coffin from the internet and come fetch it in her estate car and take it home for the night, and then take it to the burial ground, a Moodland burial, where she wanted me to go and do the service, but it was 300 miles away and it had just clamped down and I didn't. I sent the words and somebody else read them, which was fine. Anyway, Ketty goes to the mortuary to pick Keith's body up, and the mortuary attendants were so lovely to her. Oh, they had put herbs and wildflowers in his coffin all around him.
Oh,
isn't that beautiful?
That's gorgeous.
Absolutely beautiful. So, and they loaded him into the back of her estate car and she drove to Sutton Park because she wanted to take Keith to feed the crows for the very last time.
Oh.
And the park is enormous with many, many car parks and you can cut off areas of it. And she drove to the nearest car park and the road was closed because of the pandemic.
Mm.
And she sat in the car park and she wept, Susie. She absolutely wept because it meant so much to her. And in a way, you can say, but Keith was dead, he could go on to the crows. It meant something to Ketty. It was so important to her.
Yeah.
And a police car came up and stopped and got out. And these two cops came over to me, you know, the cop swagger.
Yeah.
And they said, "Hello, love, what's up? Shit, what's that?" Looking at the coffin in the back, one of these woven bamboo ones, which cremations hate, you know, because they flare up and sometimes shoot the body out. You had to be very careful with those.
Wow.
A solid coffin goes into the hot and stays there, whereas one of the lightweight ones will get blown out by the blast of the heat. So they actually have to fire up the coffin while the coffin's already in there, so it takes longer. But that's what I found out working in a crematorium, which was part of my seminary training. You had to work there, which was really important. I'd spend a week shoveling bodies to get you over your fear of death. I thought that was really, really clever that they did that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the policemen are staring at Ketty with a coffin in the back, and she said, "It's my husband's body." Now, you are legally entitled to drive a body around. Mm-hmm. There isn't a law against it. And they went, "Yeah, well, why are you here, love?" And she said, "I wanted to take him to feed the crows. He loved the crows and they're up that road and now I can't do it." And they said, "When's the funeral, love?" And she said, "This afternoon." And the man picked up his radio and he wired it and he said, "I have an essential journey here in Sutton Park. Can I have somebody up to open the gate to the West Park immediately, please?"
Oh.
And he said to her, "That is an essential journey, madam. You never have the chance to do that again." And they gave her a police escort and watched while she fed the crows.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful and lovely?
Thank you, Sutton Park Police.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when they drove to the graveside, they had three crows fly alongside the car.
Of course they did.
Of course they did.
There's a beautiful story of a beekeeper locally who... loved his bees very much, continued the tradition of telling the bees whenever anything happened. There's a tradition in British folklore that births, deaths, weddings, any big deal thing, and that indeed you dress your hives in black when the beekeeper dies, and that, you know, all these things are marked by the bees. And evidently at his funeral in the local parish church, a huge swarm of bees flew into the church, settled on his coffin for a minute, and then flew out again.
Oh, that's making me cry.
Yeah, the most beautiful honouring from nature of the, you know, the human that held them so beloved.
Yeah.
As your crows did. I must say, as you said that story, I thought you were going to say something along the lines of the policeman thought that she was trying to feed him to crows. Okay, that hasn't been done in England for a few thousand years.
A little Zoroastrianism coming in here. She would have done it. He'd have loved it.
Yeah, goodness. Well, I think that's extraordinary that that you get sent to work in a
well, it's just my church, because I have this odd church. I don't think it happens with every... Well, I don't know, because there was a vicar, a trainee vicar, an ordinand, who came down rather nervously one afternoon and stood there for an hour.
Oh, okay.
And so I think you have to go and see what it's like, but the bishop wanted me shovelling ashes.
Cool.
And putting hip joints in the... recombobulator. I can't remember the name of the machine, but
they have to go through twice.
Yes. Well, they don't turn the hard bits of the first time. No, hard bits of bone have to go through that, and then you have to pick out the metal bits from a hip joint or something, because that won't go down at all. You have to those go in a bucket, and when possible can be recycled.
Wow. Yeah, crazy, huh?
Yeah. But it was terrifying to start with, because I was afraid of death. I think we are. I wasn't raised with bodies.
Well, that's another way in which our savage dispossession from connection with the land has deprived us of so much, because you can't live in the countryside and not come across bodies, not engage. I mean, you can live in the countryside these days. You can be a sort of, you know, person who gets out of their clean house into their clean car and grows into the city or the town or wherever.
You're still going to see roadkill.
Yeah, you're still going to see roadkill, exactly. But if you actually live with your hands in the dirt, you're going to meet death over and over and over again. And the way we shy away from death is actually part of the way we then shy away from life. And by being so afraid of mortality, we fear to live, and we fear to be fully embodied, I believe. And that, yes, you know, as a quite small child, I had the repeated blissful experience of having bottled lambs to feed. And one day, one of the bottled lambs died, and it was not bottled lamb, bottle-fed lamb. Died, poor little soul, and we were going to bury it in a field, which was a way away from the house. And I, because it was my beloved little friend, I wanted to carry its body, his body, down to the field. And because he was dead and he had no muscle tone of any description anymore, as I rather ineptly carried him down the field, he started to leak from both ends.
Yes,
and that was such a good lesson for me. I still remember it so clearly, because there is, of course, a little bit of you as a child that goes like, I'm getting covered in dead thing. But at the same time, it wasn't a dead thing. It was my little friend, and I loved him. And I understood, even without asking at whatever age I was, that stuff was coming out of him because he was dead, because his muscle, you know, his muscles weren't...
He was just floppy.
Everything he was just all floppy, yeah. And that I'd be like that too. I was mortal in exactly the same way as him. I was physical in exactly the same way as him. And I swear that and many other experiences of what it is to be dead and to leave your body behind, to be the dead body, is part of why I fucking love my life so much, because I am aware that And I love being in a body, you know. It's not an sort of existential thing for me, my life. It's a physical experience. I love it. I count my fingers and toes and kiss them with gratitude, you know, not necessarily physically every day, yeah, but as an ongoing thing. I love being incarnated. I love it. Incarnated in meat.
Yes.
And if we don't engage with the physical and therefore engage with death, we're not going to properly engage with life.
No.
And it, you know, how miserable to be in a body and think of it as some kind of weird vehicle that you wished was slimmer, younger, you know, whatever, rather than, wow, this is my flesh that keeps me here on this plane of existence that I love, because it gives me this privileged place in existence on this planet, in this world, interwoven with all the rest of life. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, interwoven, interdependent, utterly, utterly enmeshed and dependent on all of the rest of life. So as grateful for the breath that I exchange with the trees and the water that I drink, and I, you know, I think we went here last time, didn't we?
But it's always worth going here again. It's
always worth going here again. Always worth repeating over and over. Mm.
Yes, I agree. I don't think I had that until I was dangerously ill.
Mm.
I'd still had the ego lock thing about some separation, I think. Mm. But the privilege, every single day, at least twice a day, it's thank you for the privilege of being alive another day,
yeah,
on this beautiful planet. And when we bury our beautiful dogs when they die, and we do bury them, there is something so lovely about putting the body of something you've loved so much into the ground and saying, thank you, Great Mother, I give you my greatest possession.
Yeah.
I give her back to you.
Yeah.
And I always cry at that point because they are your greatest possession, you know, and it's an honour to give them back, to give their body to the earth, because I'm growing things from the earth.
Mm.
You know, and just say thank you so much. And a little while ago, my Facebook friends know this, I found a baby jackdaw.
Mm.
And I left it for an hour to make quite sure that the parents weren't there, but they weren't. The tree had come down. So I don't know if it was the last in the nest or they'd got, I have no idea what, but I left it there for a good hour and kept an eye on it. And there were no other jackdaws around. So, and it was nearly ready to go, but not quite. So I picked it up and brought it home. And it wasn't able to feed itself. You could tell by the side of the mouth, mm-hmm, but it was close. So it got fed on dog food and that kind of thing. And what was really interesting was that everybody on Facebook was saying, oh, you got a friend for life, it'll imprint on you. It'll stay with you forever now. And I'm such a stroppy bitch, Susie. It's my Aquarian now. I just thought, I don't want it to imprint on life. I want it to go and live its own life. I don't want it to be something I've either got to cage or not to reproduce or something. And I played it jackdaw noises every day. And I took it outside every day. It spent the days outside on the bird table or in the apple tree.
Mm.
And then I came and fetched it. And then after a week, and it answered me when I called to it. I just called it bird. Bird.
And bird.
It went, and I was walking outside with it on the last morning, and a couple of women were walking in the lanes, and they saw me carrying a bird, and they asked us, you know, so I took it over and it jumped on their heads and it was fine. And then from one of their heads, it flew into the beech tree. And I thought, oh, you've gone.
Yeah.
And it has.
Great.
And it never came back. Now, yeah. I don't know if it lived or died. I have no idea and I never will know, I don't think. I did ask on the walk yesterday, there were jackdaws there, and I say, if bird is alive, would one of you land on the ground in front of me? And they didn't, so possibly he isn't. But and I'm sad about that, but I would still rather he went back to the wild.
Yeah.
Because that's his life.
Yeah,
he's different with a dog because we've domesticated them and they're pretty much becoming individuated in a way now as pets. You know, they've got much more... Well, they're so linked to us humans. But a bird, I love birds. I would love to have an aviary full of birds, but I'd hate it.
Yeah, couldn't bear to have them caged. Yeah, to me, a pet, my dogs could never be my possessions. They're my co-conspirators and friends and allies and beloveds. Yes. And, but I also absolutely realise that certainly in the case of Daisy, you know, if I was to die, they would need another human being to look after them.
Yes.
Well, I mean, actually, they'd have Fergus. But you know, if we weren't yes. anymore, they are completely dependent on us, her yes. in particular, because she's so old. And, you know, there's no... But I mean, our dogs actually do have the choice constantly as to whether or not they live with us or somewhere else, because we don't walk them on leads. And they are... You know, they basically are free to go. We'd be absolutely heartbroken if they did. And they, in their younger days, you know, a lurcher and a border terrier is quite a naughty combination. And they did used to go and have a little rampage around. Actually, we thought they were chasing bunnies. And one day they did catch a bunny. But actually, I think they were scrapping with foxes, because that's what... border terriers are for. They are somehow related to
cubbing.
I don't know. It's one of those things I heard once and was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think they're supposed to trot along after a carriage also, I've been told, but which is why they've got such extraordinary stamina. But I think they might be one of the dogs that you would use to flush out foxes. I don't know. Anyway, clearly foxes piss him right off, because he has occasionally, when they were much, much younger, they would come back and they had clearly been fighting something. Now, that's not a rabbit. But they always came back. And, yes, I don't know how I managed to just swerve off into that story.
No, it's about whether animals are wild or not, because if you domesticate an animal, it's not that wild and it might be dependent on you.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, about that, yes. Yeah. But I can't see it as a possession. We're back to words now.
Yes. Well, I know I'm alpha bitch, or I need to be alpha bitch with the dogs, because that's what they want. They want the alpha bitch. And when... They know they don't sit between me and my husband, for example, because the alpha bitch sits next to them, the alpha male. Yeah. Sometimes the little one tries it, but she's not allowed to. And these are the sort of rules and regulations. You have to go with their pack, because otherwise they'll get uncomfortable with life. But I'm the alpha bitch, yes, but that doesn't mean to say that they can't be mischievous little monkeys, and they have their say. They have their say. And the little one regularly breaks out of the garden. She's going to be 13 in a couple of weeks' time. And she doesn't stay out for 4 or 5 hours any longer, but she used to. She'd go chasing hares for hours on end, come back absolutely soaked and filthy and so happy.
Yes, I know.
And the lovely thing was, the farmers all knew her. They didn't think she was a threat. She knew she was a beagle. It was the only thing she was going to chase was hares or rabbits, and that's good for both, good for the farmer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, here we're lucky... Again, that the only place our dogs have ever gone scrapping with foxes is on this farm. And he knows that neither of our dogs chase sheep. They're not remotely interested in sheep.
And actually, a farmer loves it if you've got a dog that scraps with foxes or a hound, because it will deter the foxes at lambing time.
Yeah.
So that's very, very helpful. Our local farmer was thrilled when we moved in with two beagles.
Funny. Yeah. Great. How are we doing for time?
We are on 32 minutes, so I think we can call that one a halt. Thank you again. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's lovely to be with you. And we'll see you again next week.
Thank you.